This episode is brought to you by the Mikkelsen 20mm Foundation, a non-profit based in Los Angeles, California, that supports and invests in leading-edge entrepreneurs, technologies and initiatives with the potential to improve access, affordability and student success in higher education. In 2016, 20mm launched the Mikkelsen Runway, the world's first accelerator dedicated to supporting innovations in higher ed and career training. Both were founded thanks to the generous support of renowned spinal surgeon Dr. Gary K. Mikkelsen and his wife Isla. Visit 20mm.org and mikkelsenrunway.com for more information. Arabic is the official language of more than 27 countries, and there are more than 400 million speakers of the language worldwide. Yet in the US, for example, less than 1% of students study Arabic. Studies have shown that those who speak a second language not only earn more, but are in higher level positions than their monolingual counterparts. And there's no shortage of studies that point to the benefits of students at the K-12 level learning a new language. The National Research Council in 2007 found that children who study a foreign language show greater cognitive development in areas such as mental flexibility, creativity, and higher order thinking skills. Qatar Foundation International inspires meaningful connections to the Arab world by creating a global community of diverse learners and educators, connecting them through effective and collaborative learning environments inside and outside the classroom. Qatar Foundation International builds bridges across cultures by increasing the number of K-12 students in the Americas and the United Kingdom with a good knowledge and understanding of Arabic language and culture, by increasing the number and quality of Arabic programs in state and public charter schools in the United States and other countries. Qatar Foundation International supports the teaching of the Arabic language through grant giving and programming activities, while increasing and professionalizing the supply of highly qualified teachers of Arabic, thus raising the visibility of a growing profession through grants, professional development, and free online resources. For more information on free teaching materials and available grants, please go to qfi.org and ispeakarabic.com. Hello everyone, and welcome to this third part of the ASU GSV Summit series of 10 episodes on the EdTech podcast. My name is Sophie Bailey and you are very welcome. This week we're talking about efficacy and impact. I'm in two separate conversations with Bart Epstein, founding CEO of the Jefferson Education Accelerator based out in the US, and Tom Bennett, director and founder of Research Ed back here in the UK. We touch upon evidence-based education.
A lot of the dogma, which schools have kind of laboured under for many, many decades, vanishes almost instantly the minute you put it under a microscope.
Why you shouldn't attempt to be a researcher, and why accreditation isn't the answer in the complicated world of education.
Because all that tells you is it worked in one place. What we need to know is what are the factors that make it more or less likely that a product will work in a given environment so that we can maximize our chances of picking the right product and implementing it properly.
And if you like what you hear, you can check out more efficacy and impact content from the ASU GSV Summit team, including videos on this topic in our show notes, weekly email, or via the ASU GSV Summit website, asugsvsummit.com, where the whole series is listed. This week's extras include contributions from Caroline Howard, editor of Forbes, Katrina Stevens, former Deputy Director of the Office of Educational Technology for the US Department of Education, and Chad Ratcliffe, Director of Instructional Programs of Albemarle County Schools. A big shout out to the Mikkelsen 20mm Foundation and the Qatar Foundation International for sponsoring this week's episode, along with ASU GSV Summit. But first, before we kick off, here's Deborah Quazzo with the GSV CAP perspective on efficacy and impact to set us up for this week's episode.
Thanks, Sophie. GSV, we for a long time have talked about the importance of driving a return on education from any EdTech product or any EdTech service offering. And we believe that increasingly, learners and institutions are focused on critical components of efficacy. It's actually interesting today. The Wall Street Journal came out with an article that basically said that a mere 49% of Americans actually believe that college degrees are have value and lead to better job outcomes. I think that kind of indicator is a harbinger of people looking more towards efficacy and competency achievements, as opposed to sort of static degree holdings as measures of learning accomplishments. So I think we're finally in a place where the markets are focused really across the pre-K to gray landscape from pre-K-12, higher education, and the enterprise around what products and services can do to improve outcomes around learning. And I think the ability to measure those outcomes is a really important development in the market and one that we're very excited about.
Thanks, Deborah. Okay, here we go, episode 82, and let us know what you think via Twitter at @PodcastEdTech and at ASU GSV Summit. Have a great week. I'm now here with Bart Epstein, who's the CEO of the Jefferson Education Accelerator. So welcome, Bart.
Thank you, Sophie. It's good to be here.
So, Bart, I think the accelerator's had quite a lot of visibility at ASU GSV Summit this year. So I just wondered if you could tell us a little bit about the accelerator, how long it's been going for, and then also maybe a little bit about the various hats that you wear. So with the accelerator and then sort of the more academic side of things as well.
Sure, I'd be delighted to. So the Jefferson Education Accelerator was launched by the University of Virginia's Curry School of Education in February of 2015 for the purpose of improving education, in particular with a focus on making it more likely that the EdTech products that make it to our classrooms are those who have the highest demonstrated impact, as opposed to simply the best marketing and sales techniques.
Yeah, that's a huge topic at the moment and something that we're grappling with back in the UK. I'm not sure if you're familiar with a collaboration with one of the partners being UCL called Educate. So they also have an initiative where they help startups to run particular research products, which might help establish some of the efficacy of their products and that kind of thing. One of the big questions around this, because in fact the panel that I moderated on Monday looked at this subject, was, you know, if you're a startup and you have all the best intentions in the world, a randomized controlled trial might cost up to $100,000, significant time from your team, and you may even be in the sort of startup phase where you're not even entirely sure what the product is yourself. It's still iterating. So do you have any advice for well-intentioned startups out there who want to prove the measurement of what they're doing, but perhaps don't see the value in these longer term impact trials, which may not track to where they are in their sort of product cycle as well?
Sure. That's a great question. Every company at some point is going to be asked for proof that their product does what they claim. And entrepreneurs should not think of research as a binary yes, no, one-time process. Rather, it is a way of life, and you need to start small. First thing you need to do is understand what claims you're making. What do you think your product does? Why do you think it? What evidence do you have anecdotally? And then start with small, low-cost, rapid-cycle, internal-facing evaluations, A-B tests, quasi-experimental design on your own data. These things are not costly. They don't take a long time. They need some amount of expertise from a researcher. And that type of research expertise can often be brought in at little or no cost when you are a startup, because startups are exciting and they're fun and they have interesting data. And there are thousands of researchers who would love to be on your advisory board to help bring learning science and an understanding and appreciation of how to use data to your company.
Very interesting. It's an interesting one as well, because I mean, I've talked about this before a couple of times in the podcast. And the other point as well being that it shouldn't really be considered necessarily just a sort of tiresome endeavor. It's also a really great feedback loop for your own product development. So, you know, if you're not asking those questions anyway, then you're kind of missing out on, you know, really honing what you're trying to achieve, as you just mentioned. So
that's right. There's two types of research. There's research done for internal purposes, which should be ongoing and embedded in everything you do. And then there's research for external purposes to satisfy, intrigue, and convince potential funders, potential customers, influencers who have say over whether your product gets used or not. And it's really important to understand what those people think about. And in our program, one of the things we focus on is helping our companies understand their audience, how sophisticated they are, what motivates them, what they care about. We often find a pretty substantial disconnect between what companies care about and what they think the market cares about. But then when we, as academics, go in and talk to their buyers and their users, they often cite completely different factors for why they use the product and what they get out of it.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's definitely true. I mean, I was speaking to Luan Choi, the chief product officer from Pearson, and we were talking about this and whether, you know, efficacy is, you know, a necessary endeavor. And obviously, they've had huge initiative with Sir Michael Barber and the efficacy guide and the commitment to publish their results alongside their financial results in terms of learning outcomes. We were talking about whether that kind of extreme is necessary if you're going to direct to consumer as well. And his thoughts were, you know, if you're selling into institutions, so schools, universities, they absolutely will request to be able to see that value. Whereas perhaps if it's direct to consumer, there's a little bit more leeway on the types of measurement that are required. So I just wondered if you see something in that or if you differ or...
Everyone should demand proof that educational products and services do what they say.
Yeah.
As a parent, if I purchase something for my children, I want to know, was the expectation that I have about what will happen when my children use the product informed by research and evidence, mm-hmm. or was it written by a creative person in the marketing department? There's a big difference.
No, there absolutely is, yeah.
And part of the issue we have collectively as a community is we are not yet very sophisticated consumers when it comes to using research and evidence of impact. Too many people, both on the consumer and the institutional side, think that they are not qualified to make decisions if they don't have a PhD. And that's just not the case. You do not have to be personally able to interpret a sophisticated research analysis to understand the power of a group and what the n size is and how much margin of error there is to ask a few intelligent questions and to hold the developers accountable. One of the biggest issues we have is because too few people even ask the questions, developers are largely not investing in doing this type of efficacy research. We all will benefit if we all collectively hold the developers responsible for creating products that have efficacy, and if we make purchase decisions based on efficacy.
I mean, I know that you ran an event recently on this very topic, and I don't know if there's a kind of kite mark stamp or if there's any kind of initiative like that here which looks to put a quality tick against certain products. Mm-hmm. Was that kind of covered in the event, and was it seen as useful? Or
so over the last year, we pulled together in conjunction with Digital Promise and the University of Virginia a group of several hundred leading entrepreneurs, investors, philanthropists, school leaders, researchers, decision makers, to talk about these issues. And one of the key takeaways that we discussed last week at our symposium is there is no such thing as what works. There are only things that work in different environments with different parameters, which we call implementations. So if we have a product such as Thinkster Math, one of the companies that we work with and think very highly of. We can deploy it in 50 different schools and see 50 different results. Mm-hmm. So it's not productive, in our view, to have companies shop around and try their products in multiple places until they find one where it works and then submit for a stamp of approval. Because all that tells you is it worked in one place. What we need to know is what are the factors that make it more or less likely that a product will work in a given environment so that we can maximize our chances of picking the right product and implementing it properly.
That's a great point. And do you know Professor Rose Luckin?
I don't think so.
That's exactly her point. She's actually partnering on the Educate program and an expert.
Sounds like somebody
in,
I should know.
Yeah, an expert in sort of machine learning. And, you know, I think her point is exactly that, that we should steer clear of this idea of, you know, you can't measure apples for apples. And it's kind of like a bit of a fallacy to think that you are able to.
It's also risky. In the United States, we have something called the What Works Clearinghouse. And it is largely derided by many practitioners who understand that too many consumers assume that if something is in the What Works Clearinghouse, that means it's going to work. And that's like saying, here's a recipe. One family in Oxford enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Therefore, we should serve it to everyone we know.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. What are the taste preferences? What are the food preferences of all those different people? You yeah. need to understand it in order to be able to make good decisions.
So why that's interesting is because I attended a government workshop they pulled together loads of people involved in edtech and looking at what are the things that are holding back edtech in the UK and what should we address? And this issue of sort of accreditation came up and What Works yes. came up as a potential solution that was being used across the pond. So mm-hmm.
I will go ahead and tell you what I think the holy grail is here. And I will challenge your country to race our country to build it.
Okay, sounds good fun.
Do you have Consumer Reports over there?
Yes, something like similar to magazine, it? That kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in the United States, Consumer Reports does independent testing of cars and toasters and blenders and air conditioners. And it produces objective analysis that says, here's what we think. We don't have the resources to be able to do that with EdTech because of the cost. If you want to test an air conditioner, you buy an air conditioner for a few £100, you test it in different environments throughout a week, and you write a report. In order to test an EdTech product, you need to implement it in 20 different schools. You need to involve thousands of people and cost millions of pounds or dollars. So we can't do that. But what we can do is give an incentive and a mechanism for the people in the education system who already are doing this on a daily basis to share their findings. Mm-hmm. What we hear over and over again from frustrated decision makers is that they are tired of reinventing the wheel. They know that somewhere out there, there are hundreds or thousands of their peers who have explored the exact same problem within the last year. They have run searches on the web to look for algebra flashcards. They have poked around and looked for product reviews. They have looked for feedback, and there's just very little information. So if we can build a database where we encourage school leaders and teachers to document their implementations, good, bad, and ugly, and describe how they went and what mistakes they made and what they wish they had known, then I think we can have information that is of great value. The catch is that someone has to do all the work. And in the United States, we have quite a few websites that gather reviews from teachers and administrators.
We have one back at home called Innovate My School.
I haven't seen Innovate My School, but I'm going to guess that most of the feedback is provided by people who donate between 1 and 15 minutes of their time. That's what's common here. And they're like Yelp-style reviews. We call them star aggregators.
Yeah.
And they're better than nothing, but they don't have 10 hours worth of work and analysis to explain what they did, how it went well, what they wish they knew differently. And we think that needs to be funded the stipends or the support for those teachers and administrators needs to be funded either by the government or by philanthropy to give them an incentive to share what they know. That information is out there already, waiting to be organized. Somebody
and
should
it's
do
shared
it.
Anecdotally, and that's how these things tend to take off, is when positive experiences and the word of mouth. So the reverse is also true, and you can see that in blogs posted around. But like you say, it's not sort of collected and documented
that's
in a
right.
rigorous way.
And so. Word of mouth is the number one way by far that EdTech products spread, and they are highly dependent on peer groups that many people don't have access to, and they are at great risk of herd mentality. So if there's 10 of us here and we are all looking for a new reading intervention and we hear about Voxy and we ask our 11th friend who we respect and she says, I love Voxy. I think it's great. It's great for my kids and my teachers love it. All 10 of us might choose to implement it, even though it might be a perfect fit for 5 of us, but not a good fit for the other 5 of us. It's a very manual process right now for discovery and sharing and exploration.
So your accelerator, when did that launch and what type of companies have you got going through that? Because my inkling from speaking to you is that they're going to get a very good education in how to go about thinking about their startups. And there's an absolute multitude of accelerators out there. And, there's a whole spectrum of how much support they perhaps get on that side of things as well.
So we're unique. When we launched, we decided not to focus on startups and instead to work with growth stage education companies to help them scale and to do real academic research to prove that their products and services work. Now, as you can imagine, entrepreneurs who start companies want to grow as fast as possible. They want to raise money. It's not certain that they're going to succeed. So the way that our program works is we help our companies grow, but the quid pro quo is they have to commit to doing some real research, to being the best in their niche, and to proving it. So we do not have a cohort program. We do not have a residential program. We do not require companies to come to Charlottesville, Virginia for a few months. Instead, we create a custom engagement for each company to help them figure out what types of schools they should be working with. We set up new pilot programs for them at those schools and help generate good data that can be used by the company and the school. We do convenings to bring together experts to talk about the areas of academic interest. We help them with fundraising. We have our own venture fund that invests in a lot of our companies. And then we have the research. For us, the research is the most important component. But for most of our entrepreneurs, the research is the vegetables on the dinner plate, so to speak. And we help companies figure out what kind of research they should do, in what sequence, at what intensity, to what standards, and to what ends. And to that end, we are about to launch something called the National Education Researcher Database, NERD, which is a directory.
That must have been a massive, brilliant moment when that was achieved. That
full credit to my partner, Dr. Todd Bloom, our chief academic officer, for coming up with that nerdy name. And NERD is a public service. It's a directory of the approximately 10,000 education researchers in the United States, along with their areas of interest and focus, so that we can help entrepreneurs find researchers and vice versa.
See, that's incredible. So when I was prepping for the panel that I mentioned on gaming, neuroscience, impact and fads, I spoke to a few ladies back in the UK, one of which works with BAFTA Young Game Designers and one of which works with the London Educational Games kind of meetup group.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them really talked about how it was slightly sad that, you know, everyone works in their silos and you have gaming companies that are trying to do amazing things, altruistic things with, say, Alzheimer's or medical side of things, but perhaps they don't always know how to connect with the academics experts in their field. And I don't know if you've heard of the Wellcome Trust at home, but they have a great initiative where they actually fund game developers to connect with experts in their field in that way. But that does seem to be the way forward, so that it's not just someone sort of whose brother is a neuroscientist or sister, or and right. it, you know, it becomes a bit tentative, should we say, or tenuous. Mm-hmm.
Right, a little haphazard.
Yes.
The best of all processes is one in which an entrepreneur who has an idea to solve a problem goes out and not only talks to potential customers, but to a few academics who are doing work in this field. And I'll tell you, I see it over and over again. You see entrepreneurs who say, I wish I knew a researcher in this area. And then in the researcher world, they say, I wish that I could get connected to an entrepreneur.
In a way, I feel a bit like, aren't those people a bit lazy? Because we've got LinkedIn, we've got, you know...
They're terrible search tools.
Every academic page, though, so for mm-hmm. whichever specialism, has the number of all the faculty staff. Like, how much do you need, really, to just go out and do it yourself?
So that's a great question. And here in the United States, let's imagine that you are creating... a game to help Alzheimer's patients improve their cognitive tasks. Are you going to go to the home pages of every university and put in the word Alzheimer to look and see whether any faculty members come up? This is why we're doing this project. It grew out of our own frustration.
Yeah.
We went to the American Educational Researcher Association and said, do you have a directory of your researchers that we could look through? And they said, no, we do not. And we said, how do you expect funders and yeah. philanthropists and entrepreneurs to find your researchers to bring them into projects if you don't have a directory? It just wasn't something that was ever a priority. Research is generally not aimed at individuals. Research is aimed at institutions. Most researchers are looking for major grants from a relatively small group of funders. They are not engaged in retail operations.
What's interesting about that is, so younger academics are now realizing the potential of getting their name out there individually and not mm-hmm. publishing through journals and becoming sort of Twitter rock star academics mm-hmm. and bypassing all that system. So it's kind of happened, but that's very piecemeal, isn't it? It's mm-hmm. so...
But communities are popping up around this. They pop up around Twitter chats, different organizations that try to bring together researchers and entrepreneurs and funders. And so to the researchers listening to this, if they're in the UK, if they can't find an equivalent organization to NERD over there, they should either start one or they should contact me and let's collaborate. We can change NERD into iNERD and make it the International Education Researcher Database.
Oh, that's very funny. I've got a funny joke about that, but it's probably too rude for this podcast. Anyway, I'll move on. So, and then how can people get in contact with you if they want to do so and connect with you? I mean, who are you looking to connect with? Is it those kind of scale-up organizations? Is it extra funders to kind of...
So, different categories. The first category is ed tech companies that are operating in the US and are doing generally between 2 and 20 million in annual revenue. If you're doing between 1 and 2 million in annual revenue, we'd like to hear from you now, get on your radar and vice versa, understand what you're doing, and talk about whether it would make sense for us to potentially work together down the road. Our work is supported in part by the University of Virginia's foundation, in part by Strata Education Network. And we need more support from foundations that care about this work. We have a major grant from the Michael and Susan Dell Family Foundation, which subsidizes our efforts to do research for some of the companies that we work with. If there are funders who are listening to this who care about merit over marketing, they can reach me through the Jefferson Education Accelerator page or through the University of Virginia.
Okay, wonderful. Well, thank you so much. And then, you know, I always like to ask people as well the two questions. So one is, are there any books, resources, people that have inspired you that you like to go back to, that you'd like to share with people? And the other one is, how do you relax? You know, what kind of person are you? So people kind of get a sense of who you are as well.
Sure. I'll start with the second question first, since it's easier. In my free time, I have a pair of 10-year-old twin boys I love to death, and we have adventures galore. I'm also a volunteer pilot for a group called Angel Flight,
And I do work flying sick kids around from rural places into the cities for medical treatment. And I love to play sports and ride bikes with my kids and my friends, and to read, although lately with the EdTech Advocacy Symposium and all this other work.
Yeah, hard to find the time.
Hard to find the time.
That's why podcasts are good, see?
I love podcasts. Yeah. I subscribe to perhaps a dozen podcasts that I listen to when I ride my bike or wash the dishes. In terms of books, Amanda Ripley's book, I think it's called The Smartest Kids in the World.
Okay.
I thought was absolutely fascinating because it looked at children in four different countries through the eyes of the children and showed how education systems can be dramatically different based on the national character and national needs.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, Poland is apparently a very big education success story, because when the Berlin Wall came down, the leaders there quickly realized that if they did not put real effort into building a first-class education system, they were not going to become a first-world country.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, they had the national will to come together to create an education system in a way that required resources and changing everything that they were doing. And I think that's a really interesting lesson for countries that aren't perhaps in full crisis and who want to make things better. There's no magic bullet about how to proceed. I think that's a
that sense
good
of urgency
one.
Is quite important.
Yes.
Thank you again for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
I'm delighted to be here with Tom Bennett, director and founder of ResearchEd. So welcome, Tom.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about the origin of ResearchEd and how it has grown since its launch as well?
Sure. I started ResearchEd about 4 years ago when I was a full-time teacher in London. And I was becoming increasingly woke to the idea that the education wasn't particularly evidence-based or evidence-focused. A lot of the things I've been taught earlier on in my career, which were meant to be dogma, came from very, very kind of dubious, unsubstantiated sources. So things, I mean, for example, I was taught, as many people were, but things like brain gym and learning styles and so on. But there was other things which we were taught, but things like we were seriously taught that, you know, group work was the best way for children to learn. We were taught, for example, that your lesson was inadequate if it didn't include some use of tech apparatus and so on. I mean, things like that can be fairly obviously unpicked if you do look at evidence sources. But the thing is, I found in education is that we just weren't looking at evidence at a classroom level, often at a teacher training level, and definitely at a policy level. So I started ResearchEd in 2013. It was meant to be a one-day conference, and it was meant to be a day that would bring together, crucially, teachers and researchers and research scientists and academics and policymakers and budget holders and think tanks. Everybody that was affected by the research ecosystem, I thought, had a valid voice, which they should be allowed to have platformed in some way. And what I found in education is that frequently we exist in a very top-down prescriptivist model where there's a real hierarchy of who gets to decide what we do and why we do it. And I don't think that's good enough. I think that it's very important that the teachers' experiences are brought into research generation, not just research consumption. That includes tech, but also includes every other aspect of what we do in education. So we started it 4 years ago, and it was meant to be a one-day conference, and it was so successful. And it was a not-for-profit, and everyone came for nothing, and everyone spoke for nothing, and the school gave their premises almost for nothing. And it was meant to be a very altruistic thing. And it was so successful, we were asked to do it again and again and again. And since 2013, we've now been in three continents and eight countries. And we've had almost 15,000 attendees and over 1,000 speakers and presenters and so on. So it's kind of grown beyond my wildest hopes. And it's grown because I think there's a real appetite, a real demand for a more evidence-focused approach, in education, which I think is reasonably new and definitely catalyzed by social media and people collaborating, connecting in that way. So that's kind of that's the rough story of where we've come from.
And thinking globally, do you see any one country leading in a way that's sort of admirable from your perspective?
You know what? I'm going to be honest. We've now done research out in 8 different countries, and it's been really interesting seeing how the research ecosystem plays out in those countries. I'm going to be honest. I think most countries are pretty much the same. Mm. I think education internationally has a lot more similarities than it has in terms of differences, and I think that might surprise people. But I think we have to consider where education has come from. Education is normally driven by social need, in the sense that in many, if not most countries, national education systems were originally designed to deal with the children of an ever-industrialized workforce and to kind of keep them off the streets. The idea that we should be creating a kind of a vocational factory system wasn't really historically credible. It was almost like a child minding service to some extent. So that's where education has come from, and it's very much developed almost archaeologically in a kind of an ad hoc way, so that decisions are made and they frequently are justified retrospectively in terms of the efficacy and the impact. And very, very infrequently is the efficacy and impact judged in advance of major, major policy decisions. So I wouldn't say any country in particular stands out. I will be honest. I think the UK really benefits from one thing, which is a very, very mature, robust, and you know, often quite antagonistic is the wrong word, but certainly quite a robust online discourse between lots and lots of people who are very, very happy to discuss what they do and why. And we're starting to see that in some other countries in quite a robust way. But the UK certainly, I think the UK leads the world in that.
And do you think it's sort of still stuck in this sort of traditionalist progressive dichotomy, or do you think it goes beyond that now?
Well, I think what's important to understand with the traditionalist and progressive dichotomy is that even that argument it's been relatively recently that you could even have that discussion and argument online. I mean, the vast majority of schools, while still delivering lessons in a kind of a traditionalist way, would also do a lot of what I would call progressivist philosophy. And the thing is that the people who say, oh, you know, there's no such thing as a progressivist traditionalist divide, often exist in schools where it's just taken for granted you'll do it one way or the other. Mm-hmm. Or you'll take it for granted you'll do it in the ratio in which they do it. And I think the fact we're having this debate just now is incredibly important. And also one of the things that has to be remembered is that traditionalism, progressivism, is only one plane of the great educational debate. You know, there are many, many other things to discuss and so on. There are many things which don't fit into the traditionalist and progressivist plane. For example, the role of tech is something which, you know, you could see as either being incredibly traditionalist or incredibly progressivist. So, you know, it's important not to make sure that progressivism and traditionalism are your only prism. It's not your only lens.
Yes. And that's an interesting one, though. So from your many events that you've run, have any common points that come out that you think actually these are the key learnings that we've found since 2013?
I think... You see, when we started in 2013, you know, we didn't have a kind of particularly clear strategy. We just thought it'd be really good to have a conversation. You know, we just thought that would be intrinsically quite useful. And weirdly enough, a lot of the benefits of doing the research head conferences have kind of come out retrospectively. Number one has been that research communities are dying to reach schools. I mean, it makes sense in a way. Of course they are. But you know, accessing schools and getting schools involved in their programs and their projects and their research is something which can be enabled by these kind of events. And also what I find a lot from school teachers and school leaders is that they are very, very keen to find out more about research and what research exists and its you know, relative levels of substantiation. And what's interesting is that a lot of the dogma which schools have kind of labored under for many, many decades vanishes almost instantly the minute you put it under a microscope and the minute you start to examine its sources and so on. And that's been a really interesting thing to see. And so if I could say, if there's any takeaways from the conferences, because we're not trying to grind an axe. We're not trying to say, you know, you must do it this way. In fact, there are many, many speakers at the conferences that I am asked to speak, and I don't agree with them, but I believe that and respect in their professionalism and their knowledge base. You know, it's not the Tom Bennett show, is that a lot of teachers have come to me and said they've had their eyes completely opened by the fact that they've learned that there is a range of things that teachers can do, that there are different ways of teaching and different ways of instructing pupils, and perhaps even different aims, goals and values of education, which they had never been trained in.
So as part of this, getting that new research back into the training process at the beginning?
Well, yeah, well, what we're trying to do is we're trying to engage with, you know, multiple stakeholders, but definitely with people who are involved in initial teacher training, because one of the things I've been campaigning on for years is that ITT, particularly in the UK, but certainly many other countries, is fantastic in some areas and not so great in others. And it's in need of a bit of a shake-up in general. The picture in general isn't perfect. And one of the ways in which they could do that would be through kind of evidence access and so on, and training teachers to be a little bit more critical of research and so on. So rather than just saying, well, let's do it like this because, you know, Vygotsky said it in the 1920s, let's criticize these and say to people, well, what are the alternatives to this? So that's something which I think is a big part of it. And as a sideline, I was also involved in a recent behavior review for initial teacher training in the UK. And one of the things we also looked at was research access. And it was one of our recommendations we made after the Carter review.
What are the signs educators should look out for to make sure something is efficacious? So on this subject, you know, for example, are there any other types of efficacy programs or types of accreditation that you think sort of have that quality stamp? Or is it just a case of keeping that critical mindset going?
Yeah, that's an incredibly difficult one to answer because, as you say, there isn't really one single source or evidence generator where you can say, yeah, well, you know, this must be true. It's there are a few kite marks in this industry. One of the things that we always try and recommend to researchers is we try and encourage, as you say, teachers and educators to become critical thinkers. And all that's, I don't think critical thinking is necessarily a skill in itself. I think more it's a combination of two things. It's a habit, and the habit is asking questions such as, what's the evidence for this? And then tied in with that habit is knowledge. You know, how do you know if this is true or not? There are many, many great sources of information which you can find out there. For example, the EEF in the UK, which is an enormous government-funded institution. And what they do is they conduct RCTs into lots of kind of educational questions. And they're normally quite good at providing big picture snapshots of the impact of some of the kind of biggest educational questions. The danger with the summaries that they provide is that often people don't read past page one, because when it comes to social scientific research, often it's natural sciences are difficult enough, but in the social sciences there's so much nuance and context to saying that one thing works or it doesn't, that it's really important to appreciate that. It's really important to appreciate, for instance, that in some cases using detentions as a deterrent might work, and in some cases it might not. And understanding when and where to use a detention, for example, is one of the key parts of being a professional educator, or how you deliver a lesson, or how long a lesson should be, and so on. And while there are some universals we can tease out, and some things which we can say, yeah, this works for most people, which is the kind of the holy grail, it's also really important to realise when interventions don't work for people and for which people. That nuance is critical. I'll give an example. If you look at the EEF Teaching and Learning Toolkit, one of the things it says is that teaching assistants in classrooms, in general, from all the studies that have been done so far, in general, have very low impact and it's a very high cost, because obviously you have to, you know, have people in the room. And what some people have done mistakenly is they've looked at that finding and thought, oh, well, we'll just get rid of all our teaching assistants. You know, and of course, the reality situation is that some teaching assistants are fantastic and life changers in some circumstances, and that applies for every intervention. So, you know, the EEF's a great place to go for if you're prepared to commit the time to listen and understand it. There's a really good, great resource which I always recommend, which is the Deans for Impact free PDF. It's called The Science of Learning, and it's just wonderful. It's a little, I think it's 12 or 15 pages, and it summarizes what psychology teaches about learning and how you could implement it in the classroom. That's also awesome. But there's no one place you can go to for this kind of information. You have to really kind of stay literate and be kind of open to multiple sources.
Well, on the literate front, we have a book club as part of the EdTech podcast, so where guests recommend particular books and then we list them up. So are there any other books that you would recommend on this subject?
Oh, God, yes. Have you got an hour? I'll keep it brief.
Do you top three or five?
Yeah, fine. There's one. There's actually. I mean, the Deans for Impact PDF is wonderful because if you run like a journal club or a book club, it's, you know, it's an easy read, but it's a dense read and it's just brimming with ideas. The second thing I always recommend is that people read Daniel Willingham's book, Professor Daniel Willingham from the University of Virginia. He's got a book called Why Don't Students Like School? It is my recommendation for the book every teacher should read because it contains a very, very readable, accessible summary for educators about the psychology of the cognitive psychology and the developmental psychology of children as students. And it's wonderful. And it really is a summary of the best of what we know so far. And it might all be proven wrong in 10 years' time, but it's the best of what we've got. So I definitely recommend that. There's another book called The Seven Myths of Education by Daisy Custalulu. And she's an English educator who writes mostly about assessment. She wrote this wonderful book about seven myths in education, which I recommend. And also, I would recommend a book called Urban Myths in Education. And it's by, if I can remember now, Paul Kirchner and Pedro de Bruckner and Caspar, I think it's Weinhoff. Please check that before you send people to it. But those three books are just wonderful.
Excellent. And we'll throw in your own ones as well because you've been very modest and not included.
Oh, God. Well, no, the teacher proof is the one that's relevant to this conversation. Okay. And it's okay, but those three are better.
So you mentioned before that, you know, researchers are really keen to connect with teachers and schools. So yeah. I guess on the industry side of that, you've got the Jefferson Education Accelerator out of, I think, the University of Virginia, which you just mentioned. And and then here, obviously, Educate with UCL Knowledge Lab. So I just wondered, is there an initiative out there to also try and connect the researchers with the schools as well in a similar way?
There kind of are. I mean, one of the things that we can't take, one of the things I don't want to take credit for research yet is being the only person that's ever catalyzed this. There have been multiple projects which have tried to create a bridge between schools and research. For example, Cambridge University have done a terrific project for the last, I think it's like 20 years or something, where I forget the name there, so I'm going to sound like an idiot, but they've done a lot of outreach work with schools. And if you look at the RISE project, which is being partly funded by the EEF, and what that does is that tries to connect schools in a variety of ways. The Research Schools, which is a relatively recent initiative now, is something which has also seen a kind of an upswing in this kind of interest. So I think that, I mean, one of the things I often say to teachers is if you want to get involved in research, I actually don't recommend you go off and do some research yourself. I'm not a huge fan of action research. It's got some positives, but it's got a lot of downsides. And the reason for that is that, as Ben Goldacre, you know, famously said at one of our first conferences, you can end up just pretending to be a scientist. You can end up pretending to do some science for a couple of years, and essentially you've wasted time on what is a very, very biased piece of non-science. So it's much better if teachers or schools hook up with institutions like the EEF, like universities, like think tanks and so on, that are desperate to get schools involved. And so that's what I probably recommend most of all. But reach out to institutions that are doing this kind of thing. They're always looking for schools to take part.
Okay, so final question. If I understand correctly, so you used to also teach around religious education, is that correct?
It's a natural route into research, obviously.
So obviously around that subject, there's this idea of faith and the idea of, you know, leaping into the unknown and things happening in the darkness, if you will. So I just wondered if there's any merit outside of what we've been discussing and the idea of like chance, random or unexpected happenings that have affected history. So we've seen those things have a big effect. So how, as humans and as teachers, how do we, you know, comprehend this very diligent approach and measured approach to try and learn more, obviously, and have a greater impact with the kind of randomness of life as well?
That's one of the best questions I've been asked in ages. I love that, and unfortunately for me, I have an answer. My background was in philosophy, right? So that's where I came from. I'm not a particularly religious person, but But I'm fascinated by religion. I'm fascinated the cultural impact it has. And I'm fascinated by what it means to people. I'm fascinated by faith issues. And some of the issues you mentioned there, like randomness and so on, and kind of trust and belief. One thing I have to say with how that intersects with research, which is that there's an extraordinary amount of faith in our everyday life. I mean, I am very heavily influenced by the philosophy of David Hume, who was one of the great British empiricists. Who believed in the empirical method, and is one of the fathers of the modern scientific method in terms of observation, hypothesis, and so on and so forth. When you create a hypothesis about the world, which you then test, that's an act of imagination. It's an act of creativity. So built into science already is that leap of uncertainty. And when you test the hypothesis, you don't or you shouldn't know what the answer is going to be. So there's a sense of unexpectedness and wonder about science when you do get closer to mapping out how the world actually exists and how it actually acts. When research takes place in any field, one of the reasons why I believe that research is valuable intrinsically to itself, it doesn't need to have this hugely utilitarian outcome or goal, is that sometimes one of the reasons is that sometimes research which is done purely for itself eventually lends itself to having useful goals in the future. And it's like the invention of Viagra. I mean, Viagra was originally invented as a blood pressure pill, and I understand it has other uses now. But we blunder our way forward in science in many ways.
So the research always has it will have an intrinsic value, even if it's not for the original objective it was set out.
Absolutely.
For.
And incidentally, I mean, finally on that note, everything we believe in science, whether it be the boiling point of water or the acceleration of gravity, is always inductively known. I mean, it's known by experience, and things could always change in the future. And for us to say, for example, that the sun will rise tomorrow, or the speed of light is 186,000 miles per second tomorrow, is itself an act of faith. What we exist on in science is probability. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I find quite reassuring about science is that it doesn't deal in certainties. In fact, certainty is overrated to some extent. And there are very few certainties in life, unless they're philosophical ones. And in social science, there's even fewer certainties because we're dealing with the immense complexity of the human condition. And I find that both mysterious, frustrating, maddening, and also quite beautiful.
Good answer. I like that. So people listening in, they want to find out more. How can they contact you, and what's your handle on Twitter and so on?
You can just shout on Twitter and I'll probably hear them at some point, because I pretty much live on Twitter these days. I've just uploaded myself like Max Headroom. I'm on Twitter, TomBennett71, double T, if you want to reach out to me. The ResearchEd website is www.researched.org.uk and lists all our upcoming events. Or you can drop me an email at contactus@workingoutwhatworks.com, and we'd be very, very happy to hear from you.
Wonderful. Thanks very much.
Great to speak to you. Thanks.
Brings us to the end of this third episode from the 10-part ASU GSV Summit series. Don't forget to sign up to our newsletter to find out about upcoming meetup drinks, cool jobs currently circulating, and other announcements. For full references, show notes, and book recommendations, go to theedtechpodcast.com. And for competitions and more, go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/podcastedtech. I do hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Send us your feedback on Twitter to either @podcastedtech or @ASU GSV Summit, and come back next time for our following episode on China and EdTech, featuring everyone from JMD EDU, Homework Together, Tao Education Group, and VIP Kids. A big shout out to our new sub-editor Alex, a happy birthday to my husband John, and wishing you all a very best week ahead.